during the period, let's say the 1920s, sort of put that as a 10-year period, you were the title was chief chemist that time. Can you describe what that meant? How many chemists were there at Abbott in 1921?
I don't think that there are more than a half a dozen. About that.
And during that 10-year period, there were a number that were brought in. Were you responsible for locating these people and hiring chemists, or was that done by...
No, I did that.
And how did you find out about, how did you recruit new synthetic people?
I'd talk to the heads of the departments generally, like Gomberg at Michigan, and Adams, of course, I direct line to. And as a source, I'd go around to maybe twice a year and meet people that are coming along.
Did you have any relationship with the University of Chicago?
Yes, we did. Stieglitz had a quite close relationship. He acted as a consultant on certain problems, and as the work go along, we talked to him every once in a while. He was quite cooperative with us.
Did you use Gomberg as a consultant?
No, not as a consultant. To a degree. Certainly used him as a consultant with relation to personnel.
Mm-hmm. But not on technical problems.
Not on technical problems, no.
Were there any others besides Adams and Stieglitz that you called on?
Well, as I said, Gomberg and let's see.
Can you tell me something about how you started? I think you started by modifying existing products. You said you were doing that as well as working on the old ones. And that, in 1923, you had Neonel. Is that...
We marketed that for a while, but then it was superseded by some other
things. Did you make a large number of compounds? Did you just try to make as many derivatives as possible of, let's say, the original barbitol or barbituric acid?
Well, we made all those that we could think of as being available intermediates. The availability is really an important thing.
Can you tell me something about Tayburn? He came to Abbott around 1926, and I believe you were responsible for bringing him.
That's right.
What kind of a person was he?
A very intense person. A man of boundless energy. Great drive and enthusiasm. Great ability. He's the most capable, energetic man with whom I've ever been associated, scientist with whom I've ever been associated. He would die encourage people with his assistance. He would constantly hammer at them and get the work done. I never knew a more capable person doing some kind of work. And not only doing some very work, but he did everything. He's the one who started the radioisotopes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was his first assignment? You were already in the middle of something, I believe, when he...
Yeah, I was working on Nimitz, and I made the ester for Nimitz. Hadn't been able to finish the job because I had other things to do. And so I gave it to him, and he finished it in good short order, and we put the product on the market quite successfully.
In 1923, you commented in an article that there was a tendency to press on for new therapeutics before old ones were completely studied. And part of that rested in the pharmacological testing of these materials. What was the situation like at Abbott in the 20s?
Well, pharmacologists are hard to find. There weren't many, and pharmacologists themselves, the established people in the universities, looked down their noses at any pharmacologist or any person that go into the industry. That was an awful thing to do. They had no respect for pharmacologists who went in the industry. It took a long time to overcome that in part.
So what kind of testing was going on at Abbott then?
Well, we had several pharmacologists, but that wasn't nearly enough.
And at this point, you were turning out a number of...
And at this point, we were turning out quite a few compounds, which we wanted to have tested.
Now, I think you used people at Wisconsin, Tatum at Wisconsin, and...
Yes.
Lundy, was it Lundy at the Mayo Clinic?
Lundy at the Mayo Clinic. He was an anesthesiologist.
How did you develop that relationship with them?
Well, before that, members of our medical department and others too would go up there and see what was going on, what was new, find some direction and worthwhile projects. So we became acquainted with these people and had a good relationship with them. And it worked out.
How long did you retain that relationship with them?
Well, I think we still have it.
Still have it? Okay. I was interested to note that this year is the 50th anniversary of pentothal.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1936 when it was introduced in the market.
Okay.
Could you tell me something about how that originated?
Well, at that time, at the start of it, we were making seed-producing compounds and submitting them. And then also Lundy at Mayo's and Waters at the University of Wisconsin Medical School were looking with interest at these compounds that we'd submit as seed-producing drugs, but they looked on a kind of side effect or a different use and to produce preoperative sleep, or anesthesia, rather. And that's the way that started out with Nimbitol, but Nimbitol didn't quite have the anesthesia aspect that they wanted. So when Pentothal came along, that was just one of many compounds that we made for him. And Tabern and I were in close carried on this work jointly for several years. And Tabern did most of that because he could spend full time on it, and he was very, very good. He turned out scores of compounds.
The original suggestion to put the sulfur in place of the oxygen, how did that come about?
Well, it was just a logical extension because we knew, we had Nimbitol, for example, which had the sleep-producing properties. And so we wanted to find out whether by modifying that molecule we could get improved results. And it was logical to replace, well, what we wanted to do was to put different groups in that molecule, various places, any place we could. And one of the places was where the sulfur was put in. And that was the real breakthrough, because we made scores of compounds after that. And many of them contained sulfur. There was other groups. Pentothal was the best one.
Were there previous examples of sulfur replacing oxygen in any of the other series? Or was this a
no, there weren't too many places where we could fit sulfur into the molecule, but we put sulfur not only in this molecule but a number of similar ones where the structural changes were made in the non-urea part of the molecule.
This period through the 20s was a very intense period for you and Tabern and others, synthesizing an enormous number of molecules. During that time, what were you, there are three things I wanted to ask you about. Let me put them all together. What were you reading? Who were you talking to? And were you attending meetings, ACS meetings or other meetings, as part of all of this development?
Well, answering the last part of your question first, the company was always quite generous in permitting the research people to go to meetings in their fields. So that was one thing.
Were these primarily ACS meetings that you were attending?
Well, pharmacologists would have important meetings in those parts of the country. Bacteriologists, quite a few What was the next part of your question?
What were you reading at that time?
We were reading the described research going elsewhere, going on elsewhere, and that is the Journal of Chemical Society, the Pharmacologic Journal.
Medical community, from the physicians in the field at all, or were they just on the receiving end?
Yeah, so far as the activity that they wanted, there was an input, definitely. So far as specific compounds concerned, of course, they were not that source.
Were you in touch with your counterparts at the other pharmaceutical companies?
To some extent, so long as it didn't disclose.
I was just wondering whether you got together with these people, the other research directors or synthetic people.
The most prominent of that was the development of penicillin. And there, the wraps were off, and the Department of Justice agreed for a while to not prosecute us for collusion.
That's one of the things I wanted to talk about. What was the size of the research staff, let's say, into the 30s, through the late 20s, into the early 30s?
The entire research staff? Well, I wish I had a photograph here. I imagine. I ran across photograph in the early 30s not long ago, and I would say that there must have been 50 or 60 people that time.
Would it be possible, I'm curious if you have an old photograph, would it be possible that we could make a copy of that if you could locate it for us sometime?
Well, I can look.
And we could identify the people. It would be interesting to have a photograph of that period when the identification of the people.
I'll see that.
Okay, that would be great. We can copy it and get it back to you then. In 1930, you were named director of research, but I understand there was already a research committee that existed, that you were chairman of that. Who else was on that? When did that research committee start, and who else was on that committee?
Well, I can't tell you when it started.
Was it sort of an informal arrangement initially?
No. Well, Dr. Burdick was still alive, and Dr. Burdick died in 1933. So it was in the late 20s. And it was set up on a more or less formal basis. We got regular meetings and minutes and
Who else served on that committee? Burdick was on it? Was he?
No, he was sort of ex officio. No, he wasn't on it. I was chairman, Dr. Dean, the medical director, was on it, and Mr. Nielsen, the head of pharmacology, was on it, and Dr. Cromwell, bacteriologist, was on it. And it took off from there.
When you became... Well, I wanted to ask you something else about Burdick. You had already indicated that he was quite involved and supported research. How did that translate into dollars and facilities and equipment? The way, let's say, Abbott was. Did he come through the labs and talk to you?
Occasionally, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did he give direction? Did he, or did he allow you to develop on your own?
He would give directions broadly and saying, look, here's a new product that was developed at University of Wisconsin, I understand. Anything to speed it up and put more manpower on it. So.
But in many respects, you were free to develop in the in which way.
Yes, they left that pretty much to the research people.
I've forgotten who took over from Burdick when Burdick died in 1933. Did that transition have any effect on research? What was Clough's attitude toward?
Clough was supportive, really very supportive, and then with imagination and drive, did very well with the research.
Was it also in the 30s when Abbott moved into the vitamin field? I think it was the late...
No, it was the 20s.
Oh, it was the 20s?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That gave Abbott the income and a lot of activity that represented a good deal of growth in that period.
Did you have any involvement with that vitamin development?
Not so much. That was mainly that Nielsen, Carl Nielsen.
I have another statement from Roger Adams, who said that your greatest service to the medical profession was the ability to forecast trends and needs and to sense the potentialities of embryonic developments. How did you sense the areas that needed to be followed?
Well, I don't know how well I sensed them, but if someone is really interested and gets deeply involved, these things he's going to follow the literature, he's going to follow the state of the art. So there's nothing unusual about that. It's just an activity you have to engage in to know what's going on. If you know what's going on, you're supposed to put things together and come up with something.
Uh, During that period prior to the war, because once the war started, there were a number of other things that happened.
About World War II.
Yes. But you published a number of papers throughout the 30s, primarily with Taborn. Primarily the barbiturates and other hypnotics. Also with Loeffler and with Moore, but primarily with Taborn. I noticed a number of those were presented at ACS meetings as well. How did you work the patent rights on a number of these things, but still publishing the synthesis?
Well, by the time it got published, the patent was supposed to be on the way. Mm-hmm. We ran into a number of interferences, so-called, in the patent office, where other scientists would get involved in the field that we were in. But that worked out. The mechanism in the patent office for taking care of that worked out all right. The potentially most troublesome one could have involved Pentafal, but it didn't, because there were at least three firms who worked on that and got involved in the patent question. The rights, respective rights of the individual units could be identified, and so it worked out all right.
Who were the other companies that were doing the same, working on that?
Park Davis and Sharp and Dohme.
Did those patent problems tie up the marketability of it?
No.
Okay. During World War II, there were